From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And I'd say this is one of those hours that could change the way you look at the world, or at least how much of the world can be translated and understood through the smallest things. Take, for example, the snail. Those cool little creatures with a house on their backs. They are garden pests to some. But in Hawaii, snails are a powerful indicator species telling us about the health of the environment. There were once more than 750 different snail species on the islands. We've lost half of them already. Another 100 species could be gone soon unless something is done. So we're going to talk with the researcher who is trying to save them. This hour on Point, human-driven extinction and saving Hawaii's snails. Well, joining us today from Honolulu is David Sisko. He's a wildlife biologist and the snail extinction coordinator at Hawaii's Department of Land and Natural Resources. His work was recently featured in an Atlantic article titled The Last of Its Kind. We have a link to that article at onpointradio.org. David Sisko, welcome to On Point.
Aloha, Meghna. Happy to be here.
Aloha to you as well. I was wondering if we could start with the story of a little snail named George. Who was George?
So George was the last known Acatonella apex vulva. And just to give you some historical context about this species, this was the first snail species out of all of the 750 that were described officially by Western science. So the first specimen was from a lay given to Captain George Dixon in the late 1700s. And so it was the first snail species to be described. And on January 1st, George passed away as the last known individual of his species, and he was 14 years old.
Okay, hang on. There's already so much there, David. So first of all, George was 14? Is that a common lifespan for this species of snail?
Yeah, that's correct. We have a whole group of relatively large tree snails in the Hawaiian Islands, and they live between 10 and 20 years depending on the species. And they take about 5 years to reach maturity, and they give birth to one to five babies a year. So extremely low reproductive rate, really long lifespan. They're almost like a mammal, so to speak.
Wow. Okay. And I want to be sure I'm saying this right, because the genus and species name, Acatonella apex fulva. That's wrong.
Acatonella apex vulva.
Acatonella apex vulva. Okay.
Yep.
Do they have a common name?
In Hawaii, they have quite a lot of names. In general, tree snail, a word for tree snail would be kahuli.
Kahuli. Okay.
Yep.
Now, George was living in the lab. He was living with you.
George was living in our captive rearing facility that we have set up, where we're currently rearing about 40 species that are either extinct in the wild or very close to being extinct. And so just to set it up and go back a little bit, George's parents were found over 20 years ago now. Prior to that, the species was thought to be extinct. No one's seen it in decades. And just so happens that a small group of these snails were found in a couple of trees along a hiking trail. And in a last-ditch emergency effort, these animals were collected and brought to the University of Hawaii over 20 years ago. And they persisted in captivity. They had births, including George. And then the laboratory, which was rearing about 10 species at the time, had some significant die-offs in some of the populations, likely due to a pathogen that was introduced. And all of the Acatonella apex fulva population died, unfortunately, except one lone snail, which was George. And he was a subadult at the time, so he was not reproductive. So he was never able to mate with another one of his species. And people have been looking for the past 20 years to try and find more of these animals in the wild, and have not come up with any.
What importance did George take on for you and your fellow researchers?
George, that's a good point. He was locally famous, so to speak. He was featured in a lot of local magazine articles and probably thousands of school children over the years have visited him and knew of his existence. And so he's a little bit of a local celebrity. I think people are always trying to wrap their mind around the last individual of a species, and it's an oddity. And so he was pretty popular. And so he really was a great example of what we don't want to happen to the rest of our fauna, snail fauna, that's still persisting. And there's quite a lot left to save,
yeah.
But they're in dire straits. And so this is George's passing is a really good lesson of what we don't want to happen.
Well, we'll talk about that lesson in more depth throughout the hour. But I want to stay with George here because it's such a heartbreaking story. First of all, describe to us what his species, what do those little snails look like? How big are they? What color are they?
Yeah, so...
Were they? My gosh, I have to say were now. Were they?
Well, we still have quite a few left. So as I mentioned, the Hawaiian Islands had over 750 species of snail in 13 different families. And so we have snails that, and most of these species, 99%, only exist in Hawaii, nowhere else in the world. Some of them are less than 2 millimeters in size in their adult form, really small, all the way up to quite large. And George's species is a member of the Acatonella genus, which is a tree snail. And they're relatively large. They're about an inch. Their shell's about an inch, so large compared to the 2 millimeter species. Many of the species are very colorful. They come in all different colors and patterns and stripes. And their shell's conical, and George's species, Apex fulva, is named for the apex of their shell, which is typically yellow in the species, or was typically yellow in the species. And so they're quite beautiful. George was not the most beautiful specimen. he was pretty grizzled at the end. His shell was pretty plain, but the species in general was really variable and very colorful.
Wow.
And was commonly used in lei, to make lei, because the species was really beautiful and because they existed in lower elevation habitats that were relatively easy for people to collect.
And at one time prolifically, sure, too.
Prolific.
As well.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. I have to ask you one thing. One of the things about when a species goes extinct, and you talked about this a minute or two ago, David, is that they can go extinct quietly, unnoticed, until we don't see them anymore, right? Until we see numbers go down, but then we do surveys in the wild and we might find one or two survivors or none. But it can happen beneath our notice. With the case of George and his species, though, it was the absolute opposite. You and your fellow researchers knew, the Hawaiians knew every day that he was the last of his kind. I'm just wondering, on a day-to-day basis, as you kind of like looked at him in his little habitat, in that trailer where he was kept, did the sort of moral and emotional weight of that, you like literally were setting eyes every day on a creature that is the last of its kind, how did that sit on you?
That it's a pretty heavy weight, I would say. I mean, being the last known individual, we already knew this species was toast. But what's so interesting about a long-lived species like this is you can have them in captivity, and we know when they go extinct. It's a weird feeling to have. It's a great responsibility to care for that animal. We were all paranoid to handle him. And we knew he was reaching the end of his lifespan. 14 is pretty old for a snail in captivity. And we actually had him on watch. So he was checked every day except for weekends to make sure he was okay. And the reason we were doing that is because after an animal dies, there's a chance that we could still harvest living cells from him. And so we were hoping to harvest. We had already previously harvested some living tissue from a biopsy from him, but we were hoping to harvest more. But unfortunately, he kicked off on a holiday when no one was in the laboratory.
On New Year's Eve.
On New Year's Eve or New Year's Day. We're not entirely sure when he went, but yeah.
So But you have some of his DNA, though?
Yes, we actually have living cells from George that are in the San Diego Zoo's frozen zoo, just in case someday the technology exists to clone these animals. It doesn't currently exist for snails, but it may have been our last opportunity to collect living tissue from this species.
And how did you find out that George had died?
I received a text message from our laboratory manager pretty early in the morning on January 2nd. And I already knew probably something bad had happened because I typically don't hear from her that early in the morning. So I already kind of had a pit in my stomach. But I wasn't really expecting that.
This is terrible.
It's sad, but you know what? There's still a lot of snails that are left and that are closely related to George and in other families. And he's a great example of where we really, really don't want to get to and what we're trying to avoid with all these other species that are left. So it's sad that he went, but he kicked off in a pretty dramatic fashion on the first day of the new year. it received a tremendous amount of attention, which shocked us all, I think. But if anything good can come from an extinction, it's increased awareness of what's happening in our world and what's happening to the fauna and flora in Hawaii. It's shed a national and international light on this issue.
Well, we're going to talk more about your efforts to save the snails in Hawaii. So David Sisko, stand by here. I just want to read a quick comment we got on our website from Josh, who says, I've obviously never met that little mollusk George, but his story is kind of tugging at my heartstrings a bit here. Not that he was aware of it at all. Who knows? Maybe he was. More than we'll ever truly know, but those researchers tending to him for nearly a decade and a half surely did. I'm struggling to fathom that loss, the last of a species more precious than any element or mineral now utterly absent. I wonder how many seemingly irrelevant tiny treasures soon to be gone forever we just take for granted every day. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with David Sisko. He is the Snail Extinction Prevention Program Coordinator at Hawaii's Department of Land and Natural Resources. He's a wildlife biologist who is trying to stop the disappearance, the extinction of Hawaii's native snail species. He was featured in an Atlantic article a little earlier this year, and we have a link to that article at onpointradio.org. And David joins us today from Honolulu. Now, David, even though I still feel honestly rather emotional about the story of George, because we're talking about the inexorable loss, the ineffable loss of a whole species, and he was the last of his kind. But I want you to sort of also help us understand the importance of snails in Hawaii's ecosystems here, right? Because at one time there were 750 species of snail on the islands. What role do snails play in the environment of Hawaii?
That's right. Over 750 species. And just to give you some scale, that's comparable to the mollusk diversity of all of North America. And the Hawaiian Islands are about 1/1700th the land mass. So having that much diversity packed into such a small land area is pretty spectacular. It's hard to describe to people just how abundant snails were. They occurred in almost every habitat type in the islands, from coastal strand all the way up to some of our highest mountains. The historical accounts are mind-blowing. I mean, they're described as Christmas ornaments on the trees. People collected them for their beautiful shells in bucket loads and saddlebag loads. People describe them as grapes on a vine. They, like all invertebrates, play a pretty important role in our native forest ecosystem. So our tree snails, which include not just our large ones, but many of the teeny tiny ones, they glean algae and fungus that grow on leaf surfaces. So they're actively grazing this almost invisible biofilm that can include pathogenic species of fungus and bacteria that are bad for plant health. And so they're actually cleaning the leaves on these in our forest ecosystems. And they're also turning over nutrients. So all of their feces are going right back into the forest as nitrogen and important plant nutrients. And many of our ground-dwelling species are actually decomposing leaf litter and putting that nutrients back into the forest. And so you could say that snails are important for our water capture because they're helping keep our forests healthy. And so our native forests are really important here in Hawaii for capturing water and putting it into the ground for us to later retrieve and drink.
Yet another one of those tiny species that we don't usually give any thought to that's doing all this critical work for the overall invisible work for the overall health of our ecosystems. I mean, that's one of the lessons I keep coming away with every time we have conversations like this. When did you first become interested in Hawaii's snails?
I came out here as an undergraduate student and worked with a professor at the University of Hawaii and participated in some snail research that he was doing, this Dr. Michael Hadfield at the University of Hawaii. And I later begged him to take me as a student, one of his last graduate students, and I have been studying snails ever since. So I moved out here for graduate school, and I just never left. And so I was studying population genetics of these endangered species, and my role has evolved into helping coordinate the recovery efforts.
So when did you realize that would have to become your role, that rather than just studying the science of these snails, that it was basically saving them from extinction?
Well, yeah, you know, when you spend a good chunk of your life studying these animals, it really impacts you, and to see them disappearing at such a fast rate, it's mind-blowing, it's astonishing, shocking.
But can you tell us, like, I mean, like, it sounds like you're saying there was visual evidence every day that they were disappearing at a fast rate. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, our team at this point, you know, in many remote areas where there are still snail populations persisting, we were trying to actively manage them, and our partners were trying to actively manage them with predator control. I should say maybe just to frame this argument or this story that the reason snails are declining in Hawaii is mm-hmm. is for a variety of reasons. Historically, they were over-collected for their beautiful shells. There's been some habitat alteration in lower elevations that's been pretty dramatic in the Hawaiian Islands. But the worst and most insidious threat comes from introduced species that directly depredate these animals that are involved in eating them, and that includes rats. Hawaii never had any species of rats that were native. Jackson's chameleons, which were brought here through the pet trade and accidentally released and now occur on all main Hawaiian islands. But the worst predator is this introduced snail that was brought here from Florida. And it was brought here on purpose by the Territorial Department of Agriculture as a biocontrol to control this giant African snail that was brought here as a food source and later turned into a devastating crop pest. And
okay, so hold on. This is really important because you're talking about multiple introductions, right?
Right, these waves of introductions.
There was a snail that was introduced to Hawaii as a food source.
Yep. In the 1930s, the giant African snail was spread around the Pacific. They're really large snails. Yeah. They're almost freakishly large. And they were brought to the islands as a potential escargot food source. And people moved them around even as lawn ornaments because they were interesting. And they ended up across the Pacific reaching plague proportions and being pretty devastating to agriculture and devastating to people's own gardens and yards. And so there was a large effort that went into trying to control them. And one of those efforts was to bring in this introduced snail from Florida that actually only eats other snails. And it's called the species is Euglandina rosea, commonly known
rosy as wolf snail.
Yeah, that's right, rosy wolf snail. And this thing is terrible, and it's now made its way into all of our native forest areas, almost all of them, and it's just erasing our native snail fauna.
I'm seeing here in the Atlantic article they describe the rosy wolf snail as a snail that tracks other snails by following their slime trails. Oh, this is actually very like a horror film. And then and then yanks them from their shells with a serrated tongue and swallows them.
Yep. Or swallows them whole, depending on the size of the snail.
And it's doing this indiscriminately to almost any other snail that it encounters.
Yep. Yeah, that's correct. And they can reproduce pretty rapidly, and they reach maturity relatively rapidly compared to our native snails. And so they can exterminate whole forests of native snails in a time frame that's hard to imagine. And we're going back to populations that have been managed for years and have been known about for years, and in a matter of months we're evacuating the last individuals that we can find of
months?
Species.
Months? A matter
yep.
of months?
Months. Yep.
Okay.
It's pretty shocking, yeah.
So I'm going to ask this question right now because you haven't said it yet, but anytime we talk about sort of rapid, large scale, like macro scale changes in the environment, we have to ask about climate, but you're talking about predation being the major problem here. Does climate have any effect on Hawaii's native snail populations?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Climate change is this looming monster, and we're already feeling the impacts in the islands pretty dramatically. I mean, this year alone, I think we had over 50 straight days of record temperatures this summer. And so what we believe is happening is that Euglandina like it warm, a little warmer, and these increased temperatures that we're having for periods in the summer are allowing these snails to get higher and higher and perhaps reproduce more effectively in some of our upper elevation refugia habitat for our native snails that have typically perhaps kept the predators at bay. We suspect it might be a temperature thing that's driving them up the mountain. And so also climate change is altering our weather patterns. And so the forecast even for the next 60 years is for many areas in the islands to not be habitable for snails anymore just because of rainfall differences.
So it sounds like climate change is supercharging this problem. The problem was introduced by humankind, and now other human activity vis-a-vis climate change is supercharging it.
They're synergistic, I would say. Yep.
So let's zoom out here. We're going to talk about solutions, David, with you, I promise. But I want to zoom out here to give people, again, a sense of context, because I'm still very much taken by the fact that you said that just within the snail population, the snail biodiversity in Hawaii, that there are more snail species on the islands of Hawaii than all the rest of North America. The flip side of that, then, is that are we seeing accelerated rates of extinctions of species on Hawaii? Is Hawaii kind of a ground zero for an extinction crisis as well?
Our native flora and fauna are in trouble. There's many species that will, over the next decade will completely be erased. And this goes for our Hawaiian birds, which are extremely susceptible to avian malaria, and climate change is driving mosquitoes that carry this disease higher up the mountain and into some of the last populations. We have many native plants that are endangered from introduced predators and climate change, snails. So we're known as arguably the extinction capital of the world, and it's pretty dramatic. And honestly, we're the last generation, the last group of people right now that potentially can have any sort of say on what happens, and what we do in the next decade is going to determine the fate for potentially hundreds of plant and animal species in the islands. And that, I think that goes across the, the world, really, for different endangered ecosystems.
Okay. David Sisko in Honolulu, Hawaii, stand by for just a moment because I'd like to introduce into the conversation Elizabeth Colbert. She joins us from Williamstown, Massachusetts. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker, author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. It won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction in 2015. She's also author of several other books, including Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Elizabeth Colbert, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've hung out in Hawaii a lot and doing your research for your book, specifically for The Sixth Extinction. What do you hear in David Sisko's stories about what's happening to the snails in Hawaii?
Well, the snails, as you were sort of implying, are just a very dramatic and something that's happening in real time, you know, that you can watch happen in real time, a very dramatic, vivid example of a phenomenon that's occurring all over the world, particularly on islands, but, you know, also increasingly on continents. So we're seeing very accelerated extinction rates, so high that, you know, many scientists, I would say most scientists, in fact, right at this point, would say we're, you know, sort of on the verge of a mass extinction event.
The sixth extinction, as it's being
called. Exactly, yes. Coin a phrase.
And is there incontrovertible evidence that this is human-caused? Or, because I think there's some pushback against that thesis.
Well, if there is, it's pretty lame because, yes, there is incontrovertible evidence that it is human-caused. And wherever, you know, there are many different reasons why species, why extinction rates are so high right now. You know, David was pointing to introduced species as a very important factor on Hawaii and actually on many, many islands, most islands. But, you know, wherever you look, if it's habitat destruction, if it's pollution, if it's climate change, you know, who's behind all of that? We are.
We are.
Yes. One species, one weedy species, as a group of researchers, our quote in the book, points out, and that's humanity, yeah.
So, Elizabeth, in your research on this, just to help us understand, how fast is this current rate of extinction in comparison to other mass extinction events? Because, I mean, I suppose when we think about the asteroid that hit Earth that helped usher the dinosaurs, et cetera, off stage, I mean, are we seeing comparable rates like that?
Well, I mean, the honest answer is it's very hard to compare apples and apples. The okay. extinction event that did in the dinosaurs, as you say, was precipitated by an asteroid impact 66 million years ago. You know, our access to that, how long it took that extinction event to play out, is very limited. In the fossil record, it, you know, comes across more or less as instantaneous. Now, people have tried, once again, they've tried to sort of compare apples and apples. We don't have the fossil record of today yet. So they've tried to look at sort of other proxies, like how fast species are moving through different categories of endangerment. Once again, we have not even assessed most of the species on Earth. We don't even know how many species there are on Earth. But when you try to do it as carefully as possible with the information that we have, you do arrive at extinction rates, if they continue as today, that could get to sort of, you know, end Cretaceous, so dinosaur-killing, asteroid-like impacts within several hundred years. And in geological terms, that is virtually instantaneous. So we are seeing, you know, potentially extinction rates comparable to the so-called Big Five mass extinctions of the past half billion years, yes.
Elizabeth, I've always thought that your reporting, it's like the most depressing beat, I swear. But let me ask you, though, one could also look at this as, okay, if it's human-caused, it can be human-fixed. But certain systems, you know, when forces multiply in those systems, they do tip over into a point of no return. What are scientists around the world telling you? Are we at the point of no return in terms of this accelerating rate of species extinction?
Well, I think we, you know, the past has been written. Those species that were introduced, for example, on islands and have taken over extremely difficult but potentially not impossible to get rid of. There have been many successful island eradications. People are working, you know, very hard. So if you go issue by issue, you can find, you know, a lot of hopeful possibilities, let me put it that way. But when you look at the entire picture, when you see the actual trend lines in terms of land clearance, you know, what we're seeing in the Amazon in terms of, you know, cutting down the rainforest in these mega diverse areas of the world, when you look at what is actually happening to emissions, it's a pretty, pretty daunting picture.
Well, Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. It won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction in 2015. Elizabeth, thank you so much for giving us the big picture alarm on this. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, David Sisko in Honolulu, Hawaii, stand by for just a moment, because when we come back, we're going to talk about your efforts to save Hawaii's snails. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about saving Hawaii's snails and why preserving the last remaining mollusks on the Hawaiian Islands tells us a lot about what we're going to need to do to prevent mass extinctions around the world. And I'm joined today by David Sisko. He is Snail Extinction Prevention Program Coordinator at Hawaii's Department of Land and Natural Resources. He's a wildlife biologist who's trying to stop the disappearance of Hawaii's native snail species. He was featured in an Atlantic article headlined The Last of Its Kind, and we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Okay, David, so let's get down to preservation and conservation efforts, because I want to end on a note about, like, what we can do.
Right.
So first of all, tell us, you and your team, you have collected the last remaining survivors of several different Hawaiian snail species. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So first, I'd just like to say that I'm a pretty small piece in this multi-decades effort to conserve these animals. So we're a partnership program, and we work with partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the University, the Bishop Museum, Honolulu Zoo, the Army. So it's quite a lot, big, large effort that's going into saving these animals, and it's a really good example of the partnership approach that you have to take when you're dealing with species across a landscape like this. But yeah, what you said is correct. We've turned to just evacuating the last known individuals from at this point close to 40 species, and we're predicting that in the next decade we're facing, you know, the loss of 100 species or so, and that will continue into the following decades as if this problem isn't addressed.
So let's do some math here, because you said originally there were more than 750 species of Hawaiian snails. We've already lost half of them, so that's 375, right? If I'm doing that math right,
and then roughly,
and then we could lose in the coming decade or decades another 100 more, so down to 275. I mean, these are really strong drop off rates.
And it's happening in people's lifetimes. It's happening right in front of our eyes, and that's what's so shocking about it, I think.
And so the ones that you're sort of evacuating, as you keep saying, or that your team is evacuating, you have them in little habitats in some trailers. Is that right?
Yeah, so we have a 44-foot long trailer, and we keep the snails in environmental chambers. And so these look like big refrigerators, and they control temperature, humidity, We make it rain on them, and it controls day and night. And so we mimic the conditions in these upper elevation habitats where the snails are from.
And the trailers are designed to keep out people, resist fire, perhaps a hurricane?
They're alarmed, and we have backup generators and temperature alarms and humidity alarms on the chambers that call and text all of our staff if there's any fluctuation that's abnormal. If there is a hurricane, we have to evacuate the lab, unfortunately, and that's happened one time. Luckily, the hurricane didn't hit Oahu,
right?
But it was forecast to, and so we decided to evacuate the lab and had to bring all of the snails to our office building, our administrative building, which is a big concrete building in downtown Honolulu.
Huh. But of course, as you said earlier, what led to George being the last of his kind was it's hard to keep out pathogens.
Yeah, potentially there's probably, you know, there's not a lot of research on snail pathogens, but most island fauna are pretty susceptible to introduce pathogens from mainland areas just because they have no evolutionary experience with pathogens from other areas.
Yeah. I mean, that's the story of island fauna, right? I mean, exactly.
They're very vulnerable.
What makes them so such a wonderful story of the power of evolution also makes them very, very vulnerable. But so you with these survivors, can I call them survivors? Or the last of their kinds that you have in the trailers?
Yeah.
Okay, so I can't. It's okay to call them survivors.
That's what they are.
You have a breeding program?
Yeah, so we have a captive rearing facility, and our goal, I should say, is not to have the world's largest snail zoo, but yeah. We're trying to get these animals back out onto the landscape as fast as we can, and we're doing that by using a network of predator-proof fencing, and so we have a network of partners that are involved in developing this technology, these barriers that keep out predators, and the Oahu Army Natural Resources Program has been instrumental in developing this technology, and their design is what we use today across the islands. And so these fences are pretty robust. They're solid wall. They have smooth sides. At this point, we're using a plastic material. It's a reservoir liner. And so rats have a difficult time crawling up it. They're capped with a big hood that keeps them, even if they get to the top, they can't make it around the hood. And then on the bottom, we have a gauntlet for Ugandina to have to cross before they could even think about getting in. And that includes a skirt that skirts the entire fence that's at a 15-degree angle, and the snails have a difficult time crossing that. If they do, there's a little shelf that sticks out, and that also skirts the entire fence, and it's has pokey copper wire mesh that's really difficult for the Ugandina to cross. But if they do cross that, we electrocute them, and that's pretty effective at keeping them out. And so inside these islands, so to speak, within an island, we maintain them predator free, and the snails do really well inside without the predators.
Do you know, this is reminding me of on the other side of the Pacific from you in New Zealand, in order to save the kakapo, right? Those ground nesting native New Zealand parrots.
My favorite bird.
Yeah. They had to they basically, because of I believe it was rats and other predators that were eviscerating the kakapo, they put all the remaining survivors on one little island, right? And it's almost impossible to get on. You're not allowed to go there unless you're a researcher. But yes, those conservation efforts help keep these species alive and surviving, but you know, a kakapo bubble or a Ugandina bubble isn't really what we want. We want these animals thriving once again completely across Hawaii. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. At this point, you're spot on. Having these animals in captivity and having them in these small refugia, it's stopgap at best. But at this point, these animals are decreasing so fast. These are kind of our only options at this moment. And we foresee our role in the next decade is just to keep these animals on Earth so that when further developments in biotechnology that might allow us to knock out some of these endangered species or developments in predator control might allow us to reintroduce these back onto the larger landscape.
Right. Well, you mentioned predator control. I was going to ask you, because that must be a frontline solution here. Are there current efforts in Hawaii to reduce that rosy wolf snail?
We've tried multiple approaches, and over the decades, researchers at UH have tried poisoning everything, and their biology doesn't lend them to being good candidates for controlling with any kind of poison that we know of at this point. They follow slime trails, and so just to have any kind of trapping system or poison system doesn't really work, because it's unlikely they'll encounter it. These animals are kind of randomly cruising through the habitat, and then when they encounter a slime trail, they're making a beeline for the snail that made it and eating it. And so to lure them to some kind of trap or something like that would be really difficult, and we just haven't come across a method that works.
I was about to ask, like, what do we know about what keeps their populations in check in their native environments? But of course, that leads us to thinking, I'm not suggesting that we introduce another species here to keep the wolf snail in check. But I mean, have people even considered that?
I mean, ideas have always been thrown around. So in their native range, which is the southern United States, Florida, Texas, they have mammalian predators, potentially reptilian predators, bird predators, animals that don't exist here in Hawaii.
Right.
And I don't think that would be possible to introduce a species that would selectively eat them and not our other snails.
Yeah, the one of the recurrent refrains from this conversation and this lesson about George and his species is that we got here because we kept introducing new things to Hawaii. So,
that's correct,
and the unintended consequences of that. I mean, that is the story of how human beings have changed and shaped the environment for millennia, right? Like we think we're doing something good. We introduce a new species, and yet we have all these unintended consequences. I just wonder. There's no stopping that, is there?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I will say that U. glandina was introduced in the 1950s when biocontrol technology wasn't, or even research on this didn't really even exist. It was if you ate it, let's try it and throw them out there, and they stuck. And so I think biocontrol is approached much differently at this point. But not in all instances, but yeah, so different now, a more scientific approach that tries to assess all potential non-target impacts.
Yeah. So tell us again more about, get us back to, sorry, derailed us a little bit there, but I want to get back to more about the efforts that are going on in Hawaii for preserving the snail population. So you have this breeding program, you have these little refuges for them. I mean, do you have success stories to share with us?
We do have quite a few success stories. In general, the predator-proof fencing is working, and the snail populations inside these protected habitats are thriving and are expanding. And so I guess you could call them little lifeboats out in the environment. And we're actively reintroducing about 5 species right now back onto Oahu into these protected areas. And so that my favorite thing in the world is to put these animals back out on the landscape from the lab. As you said, having them in the lab is risky. Having all of our eggs in one basket, it's honestly terrifying for me to have 40 species that are extinct or near extinct all in one spot. It's not a good strategy, and so we're trying to get them back out on the landscape in multiple locations as soon as we can to spread that risk of extinction around.
Now, we'll just talk for a second about this, that when you release this, some of the snails back into the wild, you play Born Free?
I do. It's always a really happy time. I mean, we're seeing on a daily basis pretty disturbing things, these animals disappearing, but releasing these animals back out into the wild is a pretty happy time. And so one movie that I really liked when I was little was Born Free. It's about a lion that's reared by this family in Africa, and they set it free, blah, blah, blah. And so I play the theme song, which is called Born Free. I think it's by Frank Sinatra or Matt Munro. So I blare Born Free out in the forest as we slide these little snails onto leaves. It's a happy scene.
I love that. No, I didn't bring that up as to embarrass you at all. I brought that up to celebrate that, because I can see it in my mind's eye and I love it. And in fact, you know, so this gets us to one of the I think the most important aspect about the work and your team and all the people in Hawaii who are working on this, that, you know, the public's attention is drawn to extinction crises when we have those so-called charismatic species, right, that are facing a dire future. You know, you mentioned lions, various, you know, big cats. When we talk about, for example, the dwindling number of Bengal tigers in the wild,
people pandas.
People care, right?
Right.
A snail is a humbler creature. It's not so charismatic in the public eye.
You know, invertebrates, it's difficult to get people behind invertebrate conservation. Most people, interactions with invertebrates. So when I say invertebrates, I mean insects, snails, crustaceans, things without a backbone for your listeners. And most people's interactions with those are pretty negative. Think of mosquitoes or bed bugs or garden pests. And so, but the reality is that invertebrates are the majority of biodiversity in the world, and they're the main drivers of a lot of ecosystem function that's really important for our survival. And so they have a bad rap, but they're extremely important.
You know, I think people are noticing now, too, because it wasn't that long ago we did a conversation about just insects more broadly and the drop-off in insect species. And I remember people calling in saying they were, you know, growing up and they'd drive in their towns or through rural areas that they'd have bug splatter all over their windshields, and now they don't anymore because the insects are going away. I mean, that's essentially what you're seeing, a corollary to that you're seeing in Hawaii with the snails. So do you think that, like, there's increasing awareness? And there must be in Hawaii right now. You're practically a local celebrity there.
Well, the snails definitely are. It might be confusing for people on the mainland, but in areas that have really vibrant indigenous cultures like Hawaii, they have really deep connections to these animals that coexisted with them for thousands of years. And in Hawaiian tradition, snails are associated with voice. They're known as that pupukaneoe is a word for snail, and it literally means singing shell. And they're also known as kanikua mauna, the voice on the mountain. Kani Aumoe, the voice of the night. And one of my colleagues, Amy Sato at the University of Hawaii, did this really fantastic research project where she looked back through Hawaiian literature and interviewed cultural practitioners to try and delve deeper into the importance of snails. And it turns out that they're arguably one of the most revered invertebrate groups in the world here in Hawaii. And that is because Polynesian cultures pass on their history and genealogy through voice. They didn't have historically a written language. Mm. And so any animal that was associated with voice has significance. And so they're really important locally, and those traditions continue today. One of the first hulas that is taught to kids is about snails. And so it's really beautiful. And and those traditions continue today.
Well, David Sisko is the Snail Extinction Prevention Program Coordinator at Hawaii's Department of Land and Natural Resources. He's a wildlife biologist who's one among many that are trying to stop the disappearance of Hawaii's native snail species. He was featured in an Atlantic article titled The Last of Its Kind, and we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. David, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for all the work that you're doing there in Hawaii.
Thank you. Aloha.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.